and welcome to the Late Kickoff Football Podcast, the number one football podcast in all of Guyana. I'm Jamie Guyon, your host and producer of the Late Kickoff Football Podcast, and delighted as ever to be joined by Sheila. Sheila, how does it feel to be one half of Guyana's most listened to football podcast?
Feels class. It also feels class that, you know, they can understand what I'm saying. Well, I mean, like, through my broad Fife accent, because English is the dominant language in Guyana, the only South American nation that does that. So there you go.
There we go. You learn something new every day. Every day's a good day. Big shout out to all our listeners in Guyana. We're absolutely delighted to have you with us. Please pass the podcast on all your friends. Reach out to us on the socials, Instagram, Twitter. If you want to come on, you're more than welcome. We'd love to hear your Guyanese-themed Ultimate Fives teams, which would be fantastic. So, tremendous. 16th most listened to sports podcast. Across all sports, we're a top 20 podcast. Incredible. We're above F1 heavyweights, like the BBC F1 podcast. And P1 with Matt and Tommy, which is sometimes the most listened to podcast in all of the United Kingdom. We're above them in Guyana. So these guys... Exactly. We're a popular bunch. I wonder if just like somebody at a school listened to us once and we said something funny that was worth them passing it around their mates at school, and that's where we've got all the listens. It must be something bizarre like that.
I reckon we are like, you know, the Nace Bicken guy.
Yeah.
Like, I reckon we are like him, but in Guyana. They're like, listen to these accents. This is unbelievable.
A couple of balloons. I was thinking more that we're like... Have you seen the documentary Searching for Sugar Man about Rodriguez, who released an album in the United States that nobody listened to, but without him realizing he was actually the most famous singer in all of apartheid South Africa, and everybody in South Africa had a Rodriguez vinyl and thought that he must be the most famous singer in the world. Little did they know he was just living in his humble house on a perfectly ordinary job until two chaps in South Africa found him, and before you knew it, he was doing stadium tours. So maybe that's where we're destined, Sheila. Maybe we're going to do a stadium run in Guyana.
Let's hope so.
That'd be fantastic. Taking some of the local South American football while we're at it as well. But another week of the Premier League. We're on to match day three. It's a pretty exciting weekend, all things told, Sheila. Lots of talking points for us to get our teeth stuck into, which will be fantastic. We'll go through all the major games, major talking points, bit of ref watch along the way. We'll finish off with a touch on Aberdeen and Dunfermline. I'm sure you'll be really excited to talk about the Pars after their exploits at the weekend, Sheila. And then we will touch on the... I've forgotten his name. I've completely forgotten his name. The Spanish FA chap who...
That fella.
Rubiales. Rubiales.
Yeah.
Ex-Hamilton Academical player. We'll talk about the ongoing fallout there, which we shouldn't laugh at, but it's ridiculous. How can there be this many political things for us to have to constantly talk about, Sheila? It feels like every week we're like, we'll talk about the football and we'll talk about other dramatic news story that's currently going on in football that's not overly positive. But yes, we'll do that. Without further ado, let's start with Newcastle 1, Liverpool 2.
Elliott claimed it. Salah took it. Rolled it up here for Nunez to win it! The Liver Bird soars!
Darwin Nunez. He's been known to snatch at his chances. Not today.
The Liver Bird soars. Only Drury could come out with a line like that. On the spur of the moment, as Liverpool stun Newcastle, despite that Van Dijk red card. Sheila, this was just an absolutely tremendous game of football. Pretty exciting, plenty of talking points from sort of the fifth minute onward. Where do you even want to start? Let's not start with the decisions. Let's maybe just start with a phenomenal comeback by Liverpool, who... We're down to 10 men for two-thirds of the game, stuck in, and Klopp made some exciting substitutions, bringing on Elliott, bringing on Jota, bringing on Nunes, and that just seemed to change the game. And Nunes with two stunning finishes.
Yeah, I mean, composed finishes as well, which is not a word you've associated with Nunes for his time in England so far. But yeah, he's kind of had to bite. Well, he has had to bite his time so far this season. So I think this will probably see him, you know, climb into this, you know, third choice striker or third in the, you know, the front three position. So, I mean, again, I think it was more did Newcastle kind of throw it away question to be asked here? I think so. Maybe a bit naive. Whilst they're ahead of schedule, they're not going to be used to this game and like the significance of a season. It's all well good, like one off where they might win, might lose, blah blah blah. But if they've got ambitions challenging for the title, which again it would be a wee bit like ambitious for them even at this stage, then these are the kind of games that they can't throw away. You can't be 1-0 up and a man up over one of the big six and let them back into it. But you know, Liverpool showed their experience, rode their luck at times, I think also would be fair to say. Alisson having one of those games, showing his worth still, kept them in it. Bring on that kind of talent and then, you know, you've still got a chance.
Yeah, absolutely. That Alisson save from the first...
Was that the one he tipped onto the bar?
Onto the bar from Almiron. Oh,
I didn't think that was that good, if I'm being honest. What? I felt like... But it was a lot of power on it, but...
A lot of power, and he suddenly had a wingspan of about 9'5".
He moved his hands about a foot. Quick reactions, but no, I'd say that was a degree of difficulty, maybe a 6. And an execution of 10, in fairness. But
it's also one of them that when you save it onto the crossbar and then push it away with your other hand, it just looks...
Yeah, it looks
aesthetically better, pleasing.
I thought, what's it? Jose Sa had a better save in the Everton game.
You're right. A good, great performance from Alisson. I think from Newcastle's perspective, I've heard somebody describe it as arrogance, but I actually think it was more naivety than anything, that they were playing so well 11-11. They had Liverpool rattled. Anthony Gordon was having a phenomenal game. And it was almost like they just thought, that's fine, we'll just win 2-0 or 3-0 now, game's over. And sort of forgot to continue to apply themselves. The players seemed to regress, they stopped taking risks, they really let Liverpool into it. And good save from Alisson. Almiron also hits the post. But, you know, these were shots from sort of 18-plus yards and from distance. They're not working clear-cut chances in those situations. Equally, Harvey Barnes is through with Wilson 2-on-1 and all he had to do was square it. Wilson slots at home and it's game over. But again, decision-making there. And also, I think Eddie Howe's come into quite a lot of criticism for his substitutions. It was, you know, he takes off Gordon, Tonali and Isak at the same time and brings on Barnes, Wilson and somebody else who eludes me just now. But a reasonably negative substitution at 1-0, and you just... You know, Klopp then makes his substitution shortly thereafter. And you know fine well Klopp's just smelled blood there. He's just gone, how's shutting up shop here? He's taken off their counter-attacking. He's taken off the best player in the game at the time, which was Gordon. And he thinks now, you know, we're losing 1-0. So we're going to lose. Now's the time to roll the dice. And he absolutely did. And gets it bang on. And like you say, sometimes... 8 out of 10 of these games probably do end up going Newcastle's way, but they cannot afford to lose them. And I don't even think for challenging for the title. I think this season Newcastle will have really, as a minimum, wanted to establish themselves as a comfortable top four team and finishing sort of second, third, shy of anybody really pushing Man City all the way. And they're not going to do that if you're 1-0 up at home against Liverpool, who go down to 10 men. And they lost comfortably against Man City last week as well. And I know it's early in the season, but after that Aston Villa game, they're now through 3 matches and they've only got 3 points to show for it. So, you know, they're behind Chelsea in the table, who are a basket case. They're behind Man United, who are a basket case. And they go away to Brighton next week. And as you said, she's the toughest away game in the Premier League.
Oh, that's Brentford.
Is that Brentford?
Brentford. Oh, but wow. Brighton are up
there. Tough place to go all the same.
Brighton are up there because they play the same way no matter who they're up against. But you make a lot of good points. Again, you don't expect, like, let's be honest, like last season was kind of a Leicester-y in the sense that like Liverpool had a bad season by their standards. Spurs had a bad season by their standards. Chelsea, of course, and then Man United got in there eventually, but you know, it wasn't exactly smooth sailing the whole way through. And you'd expect all these teams to improve. And again, the other thing, if you're a Newcastle perspective, you've just kind of handed Liverpool the initiative, if you like. I mean, I know it's only three games and it's only 90 minutes, but if this could do wonders for Liverpool season moving forward, it says, oh, we've still got it type thing, you know. Great for the confidence, as you say. Like, it's one thing to maybe lose an equaliser, that can happen, but must have been like, right, let's not throw this away and come away with nothing, especially considering how well they played through most of the game. But yeah, those subs don't make a whole heap of sense to me. Like, Tonali's a very good defensive midfielder. I don't understand why you would take him off while you're trying.
He's just progressive, isn't he?
Hold on to a lead.
Takes the ball and
stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. He gets his foot on the ball and calms it down. Which, like, you know, when you're in the ascendancy and you're maybe trying to hold on to something, you need that, because that's what Man City do. If they feel like they're clinging on somewhat, all of a sudden they get their foot on the ball and kill the game off that way, pass the team to death. Whereas Newcastle, again, maybe a bit naive, and think, oh, well, just, you know, it's fine, it's done. They won't threaten us.
Yeah.
And then Isak, given his athletic ability as well as, you know, all the other talents he possesses, like, he's the guy you want. If you have to pump it long, he'll be able to hold it up, waste a few seconds, draw a few fouls. Everything you need to do to sort of kill off a game. The Barnes for Gordon, that have a less issue with, other than the fact that obviously Gordon was playing really well, but you know, fresh legs, maybe like for like, isn't such a sin. But yeah, I think taking off three of your best players at that stage in the game was naive. You're not going to see City all of a sudden withdraw
Haaland, Foden, and
Rodrigo all at one time. You know what I mean? It's not going to happen. Same with like Arsenal, and they're going to take off Saka and Saliba and
Odegaard
all at the same time. It's just not going to happen.
At 1-0. That's it.
At 1-0. Exactly. Yeah. At 1-0. I mean, it's getting to the point now where City barely make any subs during the game. Yeah. Naive, but not. I wouldn't be too worried.
Go into the international break here. You know, say they don't beat Brighton, which is perfectly reasonable prediction to make. They could go into the international break, three defeats in a row and 3 points from their first four games, and suddenly a wee bit of pressure. I'm not suggesting they'll sack him, but a wee bit of pressure on Eddie Howe, maybe for the first time in his Newcastle tenure. We're hypothesising slightly, but
yeah, we are. But it is the Premier League, and it is a hard run of games. Like, Patrick Vieira had played 9 of the top 10 last season with Crystal Palace, and it cost him his job. So I think it's a case of, irrespective of who you play, you've got to pick up points. Again, the Newcastle board are not going to be happy. Ah, right, I know we're, you know, languishing in like the bottom half of the table, but look at who we've played. They're like, right, well, don't give a monkey's toss, really, to be honest. So
and they've spent money this summer as well, so it is, you don't want to be going in. And just compared to the rivals, you know, you could be going into the international break already 7 points behind Liverpool, 6 points behind Man United, 7 points behind Chelsea. You know, it's not the perfect place to find yourself, or 9 points behind Man United, sorry, it's not the perfect place to find yourself so early. On the two big decisions, the first one was the Trent decision. So he's sort of claiming for the foul from the push from Anthony Gordon, probably was a foul, but not a huge amount in it. Throws the ball away petulantly and picks up a cheap yellow card super, super early on. And all of a minute later, sort of tries to get his revenge on Anthony Gordon, lays a hand on him inside his own half. Gordon goes down like a ton of bricks. And a lot of people were calling for the second yellow, Sheila, there. It would have been a red card after 5 minutes. Not for me personally. I don't have a problem with the first yellow. you know, you can call for a foul and he probably should have got the foul, but you can't throw the ball away petulantly when you don't get it. And he's only got himself to blame. The second one, I think he's so far inside his own half that you would have to be cautioning him for breaking a promising attacking play. And to call it a promising attacking play 30 yards from your own goal is quite bold, short of a sort of full-on counter-attack with nobody back. So I think it would have been, I personally think it would have been quite a harsh red. And you can sort of tell by the referees, the way the referee gives the foul, he's not even thinking, oh, this could be a second yellow, or fuck, Trent's already on a yellow and I should be booking him. There's none of that going on. He just gives a foul and kind of walks away. So, but a lot of people, Sheila, thought that could have been a red, or should have been a red.
No, I don't think it. I think it puts the referee in an awkward position. It's like, I mean, the media or the fanfare around it puts the referee in an awkward position, because it'd be damned if you do, damned if you don't. If he bookings, if he sends him off, we've spoiled the game, in inverted commas, within 5 minutes, because, you know, you've given a yellow card for some petulance. So while I agree, you know, it's worthy of a yellow card, it's like, oh, well, maybe you could overlook that, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? So, no, I think the referee made the right decision for what would have been two cheap yellow cards so early in the game would have spoiled it. So I think the referee did the right thing and applied some, you know, common sense, whether it ended his thinking or not, but I think common sense prevailed in that regard.
Yeah, and in the second one, the Virgil van Dijk red card, pretty stonewaller to me.
I'd agree. Like, I think it's a pretty clear goal-scoring opportunity. And that's all I really have to say on it, really.
Jamie Carragher said at half-time, how can it be an obvious goal-scoring opportunity when Isak hasn't taken a touch yet? Which is one of the worst counter-arguments I've ever heard to a red card. And to be fair, I think the other folk in the studio did say to him, I can't remember who it was, but surely that just means that defenders can carte blanche, start kicking strikers in the legs before they get a touch.
He's not touched the ball, ref, so it can't be a red card. It's just a free kick. but again, obviously, for that reason, obviously, like, Isak doesn't get a chance to touch the ball because Van Dijk takes him out. So, red card for all day for me.
Yeah, he said, how can you know it's an obvious goal scoring opportunity? Because he's 19 yards from goal, Jamie.
He's through on goal. That's generally.
He's a Premier League striker. Like, that's as obvious as it gets. It's not fucking Davey from the local pub playing on a Sunday.
Even if it was Davey for the local pub, you know, football has taught us, like, watching football over the years has taught us, see if you're through on, like, if you're beyond the defence with the ball at your feet, that's typically a goal scoring opportunity.
And Van Dijk's reaction, I was like, who are you kidding me? Like, who are you trying to prospect for? Because, like, he was so angry at the ref, and then the ref's like, right, it's confirmed, you're off, and he's standing there, and the ref, like, you see the ref look at him again, like, no, like, Virgil is done, you're off. And he's like, and you see him shouting, like, are you fucking joking? Like, no. And I'm like, mate, it's so obvious. And he goes off and he starts having a barney at the fourth official as well. The fourth official must be thinking, what the fuck's it got to do with me? Like, 70 yards away. And also, it was blatantly obvious. So I'd be surprised if he doesn't get an extra game. He'd only get one for the red card. I'd be surprised if he doesn't end up with two because of that. There's just no excuse for it at all.
No, definitely not. And I think I think players could probably do a bit of learning the old rule book.
Well, Simon Jordan as well today on TalkSport actually went on quite an interesting rant where it was actually quite good, because he wasn't overly pro-referee, but it was anti-elite player, in the sense that there's a lot of easy bookings now for dissent, but, you know, the players have caused this themselves.
He highlighted
Robertson and Bruno Fernandes as the main culprits, but, you know, players just constantly moaning in referees' ears all game, every game, pundits after every single game bemoaning referees. And he's like, you know, you don't hear that in any other sport. And it's no even wonder that they've suddenly gone, you know what, we're absolutely fed up of this, and we're just going to start dishing out yellow cards left, right and centre until you stop doing it. And he was like, I think he said, that doesn't mean you want little Gestapo officers running around the pitch thinking that they're untouchable. You still need accountability to referees to make the right decisions. But I bet if they didn't have Bruno in their ear or Robertson in their ear for 90 minutes every game, then they would be able to concentrate a fair bit more and we might get better decisions.
Challenge is not the right word, but for lack of a better term, you can still approach the referee, but do so in a respectful manner. It doesn't have to be screaming in his face. It doesn't have to be whinging. There is a middle ground. Like, again, you see it in rugby all the time. Like, they even address the referee as sir or whatever. So you can still, do what Fernandez and Robertson are doing as a statistic, in the sense that they're querying the decision without, you know, like getting in the referee's face.
Yeah. And you can tell when somebody, even if somebody asks you quietly, you can tell the difference between a genuine question and just sort of disguised arguing. Like if somebody says, like, oh, what was that for, ref? And, you know, for a push, and they go, oh, okay. You're like, oh, that was just a question. You just didn't see what it was for. And then you get the other ones. He's like, what have you given there, ref? You're like, oh, it's a foul for a trip. A trip? What? How did he trip him? What did he trip him with? And to everybody else, it looks like a calm conversation, but you know the boys absolutely.
But these types of things will filter through the game, or you hope anyway, they'll filter through the game down to grassroots level, and you're not going to get, like, that'll be stamped out at that level, and we could stop, like, we can maybe give the referee a bit of a hand here. And, obviously, you're going to get it from the sidelines, but you don't need it from the players as much because, you know, like, the referee can't go into the stand and start booking fans, but you can certainly, you know, react to what the players are saying. And again, I'd say the players are grown men, they're in control of their own actions. Again, I think the line has quite clearly been drawn about what's acceptable and what's not. Even on the touchline, it's not just limited to what's happening on the pitch. Like Marco Silva got one. Another yellow.
Game in a row, yeah.
For his carry-on.
He's suspended for too many yellow cards. It's three games in. Like, that is phenomenal. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, again, so I think it's the right approach from the powers that be to try and calm this down, try and take some pressure off referees.
You know, Marco Silva said, I'll get booked every game with these new rules. I don't understand them. Like, Marco, they're quite simple. Stop shouting at referees.
Yeah, just accept. Well, I mean, he's saying accept the decision, but just, you know, moderate your behaviour. Like,
don't scream and shout and jump up and down and whinge and moan. Just
don't throw your toys at the pram. Just...
He's currently on for 38 yellow cards this season. That'd be phenomenal.
Yeah, if a player was on for that many, like, you know what I mean? Like, we're like, right, you need to cap, don't you? Like,
the bookies are going to end up with him at like 1-10 every game to get booked. But we'll come to that game shortly. Beforehand, to Old Trafford. Manchester United 3, Nottingham Forest 2. That was Bruno Fernandes getting the winning goal from the spot. I posed the question in the discussion, can you score too early or can you score too early? Sheila, it's the Nottingham Forest now have the record for the team to be two goals up the earliest and still lose, which is after 4 minutes and X number of seconds, taking the mantle. Previous record, I think, was 5 minutes and X number of seconds. So, a calamitous start by Man United, though. Absolutely calamitous, but just about done enough to turn it around. Well, did do enough to turn it around.
Yeah, they did do enough to turn it around, but they kind of, I think, be fair to say, they got away with one. It's the old expression, goes 2-0's a dangerous lead. Psychologically, you know, if you're 2-0 up, you feel like you should, of course you should win the game from that position, but as soon as like one goes in, you're like, oh fuck, here we go. Yeah.
And the fact that it was 2-1 by half time,
there's still obviously a huge chunk of the game to go, and Man United did continue to create opportunities. So then the red card, what was that, like 60 minutes in, something like that. So another your captain. So again, I try not to be too harsh on Forrest because I think they kind of just went for it, and I think Cooper will be pleased with the performance, just obviously not the result, considering like how the game panned out. But I'm trying not to be too harsh on Forrest. I think they would just, in the end, just run out of steam. It was just the way the game went. But I do think that Man United, nevertheless, still got away with one.
Yeah, the middle of the park, again, they looked so fallible. The first goal was crazy. You know, you're 2 minutes into the game and they're getting a counter-attack from the halfway line. Now when he ran the whole length of the pitch, and then I don't know what Onana's new tactic was for defending one-on-ones, but he just seemed to sit on his ass.
No, I think the only thing I could like rationalise in my head is try to anticipate where the shot was going to go. Obviously to give himself a better chance of making the save, but Wanyi hadn't even pulled his foot back to like cocked his foot to go hit it. He just sat in his arse and was like, "All right, well, you just made this much easier."
It was almost so bizarre. I wouldn't have blamed Wanyi for then having fucked it up by just being like,
just absolute psyched about it. Like, I'm going to do something totally weird here, and you're going to be so bamboozled by it that you're going to fuck this up. But yeah, it was the defensive frailties there again. I think it was Rashford and Anthony that were the closest players near him. Wan-Bissaka loses the initial header. I think that's kind of symptomatic of Man United the last couple of years. Like, they'll lose a 50-50 and end up going on to concede. Which, like, I mean, what was the one that sticks out in my head? Was it against Istanbul Besiktas or something like that? Something like that, something mental like that. And again, it's just like, I think we're a year into Ten Hag's reign now, and I'm still not seeing kind of what the
plan is.
What his style of play is. I mean, like, yeah, it's been better, I suppose, than the year before, but definitely in terms. It feels like it. I don't know what, because when was Ollie left, what they were,
January or February, and then they had
They were like seventh, but with league position they were like seventh or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. And then what's his face came in,
Ranić. Yeah, and then Ten Hag took them to obviously back into the Champions League, so that, and they won him a trophy. So can't be too much of a disservice, but I just think, like, you look across at Postecoglou at Spurs, he's been there 3 games and you can already see like a massive transformation. And I don't think, like, it's just, where is this, when's this going to happen for Ten Hag, or is it going to happen for Ten Hag?
Well, I think that's more my point in terms of, yeah, the results have probably been slightly better. They did win that final and Ollie lost, what, 3 or 4 finals, and they did finish higher up the league. But in terms of just what they're trying to do, like, under Ollie, the criticism was always he was just hoping that the good players would do something good. He needed Rashford to do something good, or Bruno or Ronaldo had to just pull it out of the bag, and that's how they won games. And it doesn't feel hugely different to that because, you know, when they get one back, it's a clever little free kick. It's Bruno to Rashford, over the top back to Bruno, and squares it to Casemiro. Sorry, I think that's the equaliser.
Yeah.
And it's just really clever, and you can't, it didn't strike me, because none of the other players seemed to know what the fuck was going on, so it didn't strike me as like a sort of one-off the training ground. It looked very much like sort of Bruno and Rashford just improvising and it coming off brilliantly. They get the winner because Rashford taking his player on goes past him. For me, it's a penalty. He gets kneed in the thigh at sort of full pace. It might look a bit soft, but it's a you know, you try running as fast as you can and let somebody knee you.
I don't understand why we're splitting hairs over that decision. Like, VAR is in play now, so if it's a dive, it'll be picked up.
It's just a foul. It's nothing crazy, but it's a foul.
Yeah, it's a foul. It's a foul on the box. It's a penalty. So,
yeah,
if
that's in the centre circle,
he's got to absolutely take his leg off before we're like, all right, well, that's a penalty. Like, no, exactly. Again, as you say, if it's anywhere else on the pitch, it's a foul, no problem. And with VAR checking all these things, dive.
Yeah, exactly. They'll get pulled up.
So it's not really a topic of debate for me, but back to Man United. Yeah, like, I think that even Fernandes tries later on in the game something cute to Dalot, like the Weghorst
free kick.
Yeah, and even Dalot's not expecting it. You're like,
Dalot's like, what the fuck are you doing?
And it's
like, I'm Diego Dalot,
like,
mate. I'm not going to notice that.
No, but exactly. Yeah, but like, if you were, and I think I can't remember who the commentator was, but basically said, look, if you're going to do that, then you need to tell me about it. And it's just like, again, how can it be off the training ground if no cunt knows you're about to do it? So I just, to go back to the overall plan here, it's just, it's not really coming together. Man United don't really feel in control of games at the moment, and that would be the worrying thing for me. That they don't dictate things. It's very much what can we do around the opposition, as opposed to we're Man United, we're going to take charge and we're going to win.
And Casemiro just looks sort of a yard short this season compared to last. And we said, you know, what would he be like alongside Eriksen instead of Mount? And it didn't seem to make any difference. They concede those two goals early that both come through the middle. Is it Bolly that scores the corner and he doesn't even have to jump?
Bounces off his face and goes in.
Yeah, from the middle of the box.
It's ridiculous. To have a defender not even have to jump to make contact with the ball, that's absolutely ludicrous. No fighting whatsoever.
A boy as obvious as Bolly as well.
Exactly. All right, here's this guy coming and someone pick up him. Who's their tallest guy? Get on him.
Yeah.
Type thing, or who's our best jumper? And it's just...
It's strange because they played Rashford on the left, which we advocated last week. They went for Martial through the middle. I think we thought Sancho might play through the middle when we discussed it last week. And it was a surprise he didn't, because Martial was, it was a 3 o'clock kickoff. So, you know, you're on the match of the day highlights. But I don't think Martial's name was mentioned once, nor did I see him do anything, which is usually a sign that he wasn't involved. And I listened to the second half on the radio and I didn't hear him mentioned then either. So, you know, that hasn't worked. Antony still looked shit, even though Garnacho wasn't on the other side and was consistently giving the ball away. Like we say, the Casemiro and Eriksen in the middle didn't really seem to be working. So it is worrying for United, because they're not in the market for anybody, as far as I'm aware. Well, they are.
Kukurea. Yeah. Well, that doesn't make it, again, I know, I feel like we've been here before. Sure. Feel like we've been here before. With Ollie, but it's a case of, like, again, I'll use Postecoglou as you know, sort of the reverse, is that he's came in, he's not made a huge amount of signings, he's lost his best player, but he's brought in Maddison and he's brought in the left back Destiny, but beyond that, like, you know, Bissouma, who's been one of their better performers so far this season, was left in the cold last year. He's been brought in and looks like a different guy. Yeah, Papsar's another one. So again, it's just with Ten Hag, I'm like, hey, well, who have you improved? And if you can't improve them, you outright replace them. And again, like, Kukurea, like, well, what has he shown you in the past year? That's like,
Right, Chelsea have sold two big players this summer. They've sold Havertz to Arsenal, and we'll come to Arsenal in a moment, but that isn't working. That's going exactly the way every Chelsea fan would have told you it would go. And then we've sold Mason Mount to Man United, and in the first two games as a number eight, that didn't work, which every Chelsea manager had tried to say before: Mason Mount can't play as a number eight. And Man United seem to be like, well, maybe it'll be third time lucky and we'll buy another Chelsea player that nobody thinks is any good, and maybe this one will work out. And the talk is it's going to be a £7 to £10 million loan fee and potentially an obligation to buy. I'm like, have Chelsea won the fucking lottery this summer?
It feels like one of those lottery winners that spunks all the money in a year and ends up on the rash, bones of the rash within. But that's it. But going back to, it's not, don't go to Chelsea yet, but yeah, back to United. Where's the structure? Where's the who's signing off on all these deals? Again, there's another protest about the Glazers and all that. And again, yes, there are problems with that ownership, but you can't accuse them of not putting their hand in their pocket when it comes to investing in the squad. And it's just like, who the fuck is controlling these signings? Like, again, I don't want to write off, like, I wouldn't say any of them have been failures, but they're hardly lit the world up, you know? Like,
well, I think we're at the point almost of saying Antony's a failure. I don't think we're far off.
Antony's a failure when you take into account the fee, and it's like, that's money down the drain. And again, you look at other players that have been signed for similar money, and it's just like, Man United, why are Man United getting seen off by Ajax? And it's just like, again, Martinez was from Ajax, and they're just like, fuck's sake.
Do you think maybe Ten Hag's playing double agent here? He's gone to United. He's going to buy all of Ajax's players for 80 to 100 million, go back to Ajax, take them all back for 5 to 10 million, and then pocket half the difference. That's maybe the plan.
It's the only thing that makes any sense. But no, again, you've got Hodgson to come into the side, and we'll see what happens from there. But nobody's got any idea
if he's any good or not.
No. Like, hopefully he provides, you know, an outlet for, you know, Rashford and that to thrive on. It's just like you're just wasting more money. The amount when you put it like that, it just proves to be even more puzzling. Like, you already have Fernandes in the sort of 8-10 role. So why would you sign another 10 who's not as good for like decent money when, you know, you could have got, I don't know, like a better defensive midfielder partner for Casemiro, who is a good age now, right enough. He's not like ancient, but he's 31. So
he's played a lot of football. He's sort of one of those 31s that, you know, started young as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So like, if you had another guy there who was of a similar quality that could play.
Well, you think somebody like Kovacic went to City for 25 million and you know, he wanted a new challenge, which is why he wanted out of Chelsea, and that's fine. But, you know, maybe it was impossible. Maybe he only wanted to go to City. But that kind of signing would seem infinitely more sensible for Man United in the middle of the park. Why aren't they being touted with Paulinho at Fulham, who doesn't seem to look like he would cost a huge amount of money and was superb last season and has started well again this season with a good performance against Arsenal? So it seems like there's options there for United to spend sensible money, and instead they might be, you know, taking Cucurella, who Chelsea would be delighted to get off their books, to play for what, 4 months until Luke Shaw's back, and then they'll just play Luke Shaw.
What's happened to Malacia? Is he injured?
Well, he's pish, isn't he? So that's maybe what's happened to Malacia.
Yeah, but that's another Ten Hag signing, though.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Like, if he's just like, oh, I will come in, and if he's shite, then we'll just bin him, like, and then we'll buy someone else who's also shite for more money. And they were just constantly going through the cycle. Like, I feel like I've still got Maguire on the books, and I know that
he's been told he's staying as well.
He's been told he's staying, or he's like, right, well, we
no, but the headline in the Guardian was United push back West Ham until Maguire is staying.
Yeah, but probably I don't think it's. Just, I think neither one of us believe it's as straightforward as that. It's like
West Ham
would probably like to take him, and then they're like, right, well, it's going to cost you X amount of million, and it's like, right, fine, we're happy enough to pay that. And they get a look at Maguire's contract, and like, there's no way we're going to be able to touch that. So it's like, right, we'll take him on loan, and again, like, Man United, right, well, you're going to have to pay all of his wages. We're not budging on that, and they're like, right, no, you're all right, we'll look at other targets. So they're kind of stuck with Harry Maguire, as opposed to, we like Harry Maguire. Like, I think we all know that Maguire's not what Ten Hag's looking for.
I see that Varane's out for, 4 to 6 months? Off the back of his first half injury against Forest. Maybe that's why Maguire's being told he's staying.
Well, yeah, Maguire is, but I'd much rather I'd rather bring Malacia back into the squad and use the money you're going to use for Cucurella to get another centre back.
Yeah, exactly. And you've obviously got Lindelof there as well to play alongside Martinez, who isn't a mug. And Johnny Evans on 12 months.
Exactly, yeah. But if you went to the effort of getting rid of De Gea, and I'd say pretty sour terms considering how long he's been there, you bring in Onana with the intention to be able to play out from the back, and yeah, injuries can't be helped, but then you're still stuck with Harry Maguire, who's the other half of that shite equation. And it's like, well...
There's a genuine possibility that Man United could line up with Cucurella, Harry Maguire, and Johnny Evans is 3 back 4. Like, fucking hell. and with a defensive midfield that can't stop people running through them. Like, if that team came up against Man City, They wouldn't have to worry about the 7-0 against Liverpool for much longer.
Yeah, it could be double digits. But that's the problems that we kind of Man United have at the moment. He's been there long enough now that we should have seen some sort of progress. I just don't feel like we've seen that at all.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. Forest, you know, they've got a win under the belt already. Their away record was dreadful. They probably didn't expect to get anything out of this game, albeit they'll be gutted once they're 2-0 up. The weird thing from Forest was that they came out and said that they were considering writing a complaint to the PGMOL about the refereeing performance. And certainly there was nothing on Match of the Day, I thought, to get excited about. The Joe Worrall sending off looked pretty cut and dry to me. You know, Bruno's ahead of him. He trips over, grabs his shorts and pulls him down. You know, there was a question about whether Bolly would have got back or whether the goalie would have made it out, but it didn't look like it. And you can't fall over at the edge of the box and pull somebody down by their shorts and then complain when you get sent off for it, as far as I'm concerned.
No, I don't even think Worrall made that much of it. So probably knew that, like, right, okay, this is a decision. I've given the referee a decision to make here. And obviously that's what's happened. But no, I didn't think it was a particularly bad performance.
There was a Rashford penalty. Like, I don't really... penalty is a penalty. It seems like a strange one to do.
Exactly. You know? Like, I mean, you know, if the authorities are after more toilet roll, I'm sure they're about to get some for this letter.
We are unhappy
about the correctness of the decisions. Yeah,
like, we're unhappy that we were 2-0 up and we lost.
And in a nutshell, that's all it is. Like, you know what I mean? Like, complaining about decisions that went against you rather than being incorrect. Like, Nottingham Forest are not writing to complain about decisions that went in their favour, are they? So
exactly. Yeah, there was a suggestion, I can't remember, it didn't make it to Match of the Day, but I had seen from United fans at the game that there was an argument that one of the Forest players should have had a second yellow. So it doesn't sound like they were complaining about that, but at all. Let's move on. Arsenal 2, Fulham 2.
Reed's corner, Arsenal have a clear head, Toto! Goal, Paulinho! Piercing the Gunners' defence at the end of the game. Back.
There's that man I just said United should have been in for. Paulinho popping up late on to get a 2-2 draw against Arsenal. This was an interesting game, Sheila. Fulham with the fastest goal of the season so far, 50-odd seconds. Absolutely no idea what Aaron Ramsdale's doing. I know he probably doesn't expect Saka to play a through ball to Andres Pereira, which is fair enough, but he's like... standing in such a peculiar position that he ends up almost doing a 360 trying to save the ball, which goes past him. And he's a player in that Arsenal team. He's probably the number one player that can't afford to put in a poor performance with David Raya.
David Raya, yeah.
So not a great start for Arsenal. They then turn it around. Saka penalty and Nketiah comes on and scores. A bit of controversy around that second goal. Calvin Bassey's lying effectively on the touchline, grabbing his thigh. So he's playing everybody on, but grabbing his shoulder. But that's one of them where Bassey's had an absolute nightmare because he's gone down, grabbed his shoulder, expecting the game to be stopped. It hasn't been stopped. He's thought, well, I need to just stay down and sell this. And then he's played Nketiah. I think actually... it's quite funny. Nketiah clearly held his run, not himself realizing that Calvin Bassey was playing everything.
It was kind of like, had Bassey been off the field of play, it'd been miles off. But like, yeah, it was kind of like
officially off the field of play. If he just rolls off, it's the touchline. Yeah. But yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah. Oh my god. Like, I'm actually onside here and I'm miles on. But yeah, strange. Like, Bassey should probably have. In fact, Fulham as a whole should be like, that's the most best day one stuff football, like play the whistle.
Yeah, just get up, get your arse off the ground. You know, you're not going to get the game sort for a wee coming together.
Or remove yourself so that, you know, you're not like, do something. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, to get your shit you're just a hindrance. Basically, it was, have a good game.
Really, well, he didn't know. He got the booking for time wasting, and we're seeing them coming out regularly. And then the second booking's an absolute stick on. You know, he pretty much gives was it Nketiah, like gives him a hug in the middle of the park as he goes through the past, and he's walking off before Paul Tierney can get the second yellow out. But Arsenal, you know, 2-1 up against 10 men, and then concede poorly from a corner, really poorly. And we discussed it at length several times last season, Sheila, that a team that concede as many goals as Arsenal are incredibly unlikely to win the league, because they will just throw away points naturally by conceding so many goals. And that's, you know, 2-2 with Fulham this week. They conceded to Forest in the first game. Was it Forest? Yeah, in the first game of the season when they were 2-0 up, they conceded. And last week was 1-0 against Palace with the Tomiyasu red card. But, you know, they've conceded sort of 3-3, which is not where you expect title challengers to be. And in a season, again, where we know that they can't give away too many points, that's two really, really soft points given away really early.
Yep. And again, these are the margins that will cost you in a title race against a team as strong as City. Yeah, 2 points, only 3 games in, you don't think it's going to be significant, but it really is come crunch time. And given the position they were in the game, a goal and a man up, it's inexcusable, to be honest. It's not really what champions are made of. You know, like, again, I wouldn't even say that Arsenal played particularly poorly as such, but
They didn't look brilliant. And you've got the Havertz experiment, as I alluded to earlier, really isn't working. And I don't know what they expected.
I thought that he was being signed basically not as a squad player as such, but a rotation, because that's what Arsenal were missing last year when injuries and, you know, just the length of the season, as a World Cup, throwing a World Cup in there as well, that you needed more legs. Like, again, I thought he was going to probably rotate with, like, sort of Jesus if he gets injured, or Trossard, or Martinelli. Even though I think the only one that's indispensable in that team is probably Saka. I don't know why.
There was a suggestion he would play in the middle, but if there's a place in the middle he would play, it would be Odegaard's position. And he's not going to play over Odegaard.
Exactly. So, no, he's not. And again, that's why I thought he would be signed. Like, again, you're using City as the blueprint. Players are signed for big amounts, but I think everybody that walks into City's changing room knows that they're not going to be guaranteed to start every single game. And they're quite happy with that. So I don't understand why Arsenal are trying to pigeonhole him into the centre mid role and then
pushing Partey to right
Partey out to the right, yeah. So I just think that Partey and Rice provide a much more balanced Arsenal side than Havertz and Rice.
Yeah, and then Odegaard. Yeah, it is slightly odd, and it isn't, you know, they played Trossard through the middle at the weekend, and then Nketiah came on and made a bit of a difference, Martinelli and Saka. But yeah, the Havertz in the middle and the Partey at right back thing doesn't seem to be working. And then also you end up with Ben White at centre back. I don't know what Gabriel's done to sort of find himself out of favour there. He's been on the bench the last few games.
This is when football managers, I think, try to get too cute. And maybe a touch of arrogance as well. I'll just fling fucking Partey out, right?
And he wants to play inverted. He wants to play with an inverted fullback. And, you know, Mike discussed it at length last year. Last year it was Zinchenko at left back, and he moved into midfield and sort of changed things a bit. And it seems like he's shoehorning Partey into right back to be the guy that steps into midfield, because Kvyat can't do it from the left. But surely you sacrifice the guy stepping into midfield in favour of having an actual back four than insisting on an inverted fullback. Surely you keep Ben White at right back, where he played well last season, and play Gabriel.
If you're asking me who do I think is more capable of being an inverted fullback, it would be Ben White, because he's shown that he's comfortable on the ball to the same, but to a similar quality as Zinchenko. And obviously he has the capabilities. He's a defender as well. So again, we've heard that it feels like the term inverted fullback is the next sort of fashionable thing in football. But if you've not got the personnel to do it, there's no. Don't take a player who has some of the skills that are required, and fuck it, we'll put him at right back because he's not a right back.
So, playing an inverted fullback is not the same as making sure you play a striker, where you might play Trossard up front because you need somebody up front. You kind of play them in a false nine to bounce off of. Or Man United were playing Rashford when that's not his favoured position. Like, it's not a position. An inverted fullback is not like a mandatory part of your starting 11. Like,
you're playing fucking Fulham. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Sometimes, yeah. Don't you beat yourself.
I mean? Yeah, it's like. I think again, City. Jesus Christ, talking about them in some length, but they are the best team in the world. And now if Pep's going to do something like that, it is typically in a big game to catch your opposition manager off guard. Doesn't do it against fucking who were they playing the weekend? Sheffield United.
He doesn't play Rodri at left back at the weekend.
You've got to beat the team in front of you, and playing Ben White at right back and Gabriel at centre back would have been fine, more than enough to do that. So yeah, I think in a sense Arsenal have thrown away 2 points needlessly there. Other than the fact that the performance was shite, like they just tactically they got it wrong, overcomplicated it.
Yeah, absolutely. And to throw 2 points to City this early in the season, we weren't really going to talk City game. It's a bit further down the list. And They obviously beat Sheffield United 2-1. United having equalised, I think Heckenbottom said, look, we just tried to stay in the game and hope that we could nick it in the last 15 minutes. And they very, very nearly did, save for a stunning finish by Rodri. But if you're Arsenal and you were hoping to challenge City again, I'd be terrified by how just efficient Man City look this year. Like, they have by no means looked sort of at Man City's level, which we know they turn on in sort of January when they go on these runs, as they do every season at the moment. And yet they just seem to be dispatching the teams in front of them. They completely nullified Newcastle last week. They made Burnley look silly. They were a bit off it against Sheffield United, and then yet Sheffield United equalised and Kyle Walker went into some kind of Terminator rage mode and made sure they won the game. And you just look at that team and you think, fuck, this is the time of the season they usually drop points, and they look like they're in no danger of dropping points.
They haven't. And they're still, they're still making signings as well. They're still adding, Doku's been signed, Guardiola looks, again, I don't understand, sometimes I just don't understand football teams. How are Man City getting a free run at that guy?
Yeah.
Seriously, how are they getting a free run at that guy? Like, no one else even bothers to try. Obviously he's going to be on extremely high wages, but nevertheless, like, Man United could probably match that or something like that. Chelsea would be another one. You're like, right, fucking, they could.
I think Chelsea needs a fucking winger.
No, I don't mean Doku. I mean
Vardy.
Vardy, yeah.
Yeah. To be fair, Chelsea tried in January and then eventually got knocked back. But you're right. The fact that United aren't in there. And Arsenal need a centre-back. You know, if they're playing Ben White instead of Gabriel, that would suggest to me that they're in need of a centre-back.
Yeah, that is a strange one. I know Gabriel's been linked with a move to Saudi Arabia, but yeah, it's a strange one. Obviously,
and that would really leave them short.
The injury to Timber is horrendous, but just Man City are just... just unbelievable. They're just unbeatable.
Let's move on. And let's do probably the biggest shock of the weekend, certainly pre-match, which was West Ham United 3, Brighton and Hove Albion 1.
And Bowen was able to keep it in. Looking for Mikel Antonio. This is Antonio! From bad to worse for Brighton.
And it's An incredible finish by Antonio makes Adam Webster look like an absolute tit when he does a little drop of the right shoulder and goes the other way. He's like a centre in basketball, sort of posts him up and turns him and slots it home. Great start to the season for West Ham. After this game on Saturday, they were top of the league. 3-1 against Brighton, backing up a 3-1 win against Chelsea in the game last week. They look like they've just gone back to playing full David Moyes mode. It was almost like last year, you know, he struggled a bit with Paquetá, who seems to be fitting into the team well now. He really struggled with Scamacca, didn't know what to do with him. And now he's just gone, you know, he signed James Ward-Prowse, who's such a David Moyes player. He shoved Antonio back up front through the middle, who's the ultimate David Moyes player. And he's like, you know what, fuck, I'm David Moyes. I'm just going to David Moyes everybody from now on. They had 18% possession at the point they went 3-0 up. Like, that's insane. And 6% possession per goal is ridiculous. And Brighton had a few chances, but yeah, West Ham, Moyes just Moyes them, as he did Chelsea last week.
Yeah, and he deserves great credit for it as well. Brighton did have some opportunities, but they were mostly restricted to outside the box. But yeah, I think, like, again, if we are, like, again, we'll use City. If City come out and play to their absolute best and destroy a team 4-0, 5-0, we're giving Pep all the plaudits. This was just the same, but in reverse. Like, David Moyes just played
to his absolute
strength. His absolute best, and that's what happened. I wouldn't be too upset if I was deserted, because, again, doesn't always work like that. I think they play this game again and maybe if they win another 10 times, they probably win more than they lose. But West Ham deserve, and Moyes deserve great credit for how they apply themselves, because Brighton will roll over a lot of teams this year. This particular game just got caught out, and that's all it was. It wasn't like a smash and grab from West Ham. No, they thoroughly deserved 3 points for how they defended. They were disciplined, they didn't give anything cheap away, and they just took their chances when they were available. So
that's the big difference, isn't it? You know, you compare West Ham to Arsenal or Man United, who albeit have more of the ball, but both the goals Arsenal concede, they've literally given away. Ramsdale has an absolute... Saka and Ramsdale conspire to give away the first goal, and then Paulinho gets a free shot in the box from a corner. Likewise, Man United, they've got a guy running through one-on-one for half the pitch 2 minutes into the game, and then, as we've said, Willy Bully scores a header without jumping. They just completely conspire to concede goals. Newcastle the same, conspire to concede against a 10-man Liverpool team, whereas this was a great example of a team who were like, we will not defeat ourselves. If you beat us, fine. You know, we're here, and if you win, fine. But we will not beat ourselves, and that will give us a chance, if you can't score, to go up the other end. And I love Antonio. Absolutely. Like, he's like a good Danny Welbeck. Like, is there a more selfless player in the Premier League? And the guy just... when he got taken off, I think it was like 75 minutes, he could hardly walk to the sideline because he was so fucked. But he's just like chasing defenders, bombing around. And he's constantly the guy that's like making a 20, 30 yard lung busting run on the counter attack to give an option, which sometimes doesn't get to him. But he does it again and again and again. And ultimately that helps lead to, it's him that wins the ball, plays it out to Benrahma for the Bowen goal. And then it's him that makes the lung busting run for the third at the end there.
Yeah, I think, look, I think obviously Premier League footballers are all good footballers, but some are more limited than others. But the one thing that Antonio does that others don't is he gives 100% at all times. So running 35 yards, if that's what the team, to run at 35 yards full pace, you might end up with absolutely hee-haw to show for it at the end. But if that's what the team needs you to do, then he's going to do that for you. And that's what us as fans all like from our, you know, the minimum we expect from our players that play for our team is to do that. You're going to get folk that are like, you know, not as good technically and all that. That's just something that happens. But as professional athletes, you do expect this type of thing. And Antonio was the absolute peak of that. Like, he'll run through brick walls for you if you ask him to. And like, you know, I think just last year was not his year, but this year he
wasn't West Ham's, was it? You know,
no, it wasn't.
He had unusual players around him. He's kind of gone back to just being trusted, just to work hard.
Look, and I think that's a hallmark of David Moyes' teams. Like he gets players around him that he trusts. And I think Antonio is very easy to trust because you know what you're going to get from him. He's not going to do anything daft or stupid or rash. And he's not going to make it about himself. So he's just like a very good pro.
Yeah. And he's got enough of, you know, he's not Neil Mopai who then can hit a barn door with a banjo.
No, exactly.
End.
Again,
he is a finisher.
Maybe I'm underplaying his abilities by saying, oh, he can just run. But again, he's good with his feet and in the air. He's just a very, very solid Premier League player. You know what I mean? If you're in Everton, for example, you'd kill for a Mikel Antonio Rabbit.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I think some of the teams a little bit higher up the league would say a Brighton could probably do with a Antonio right about now.
Brentford. Fit right into the Brentford
exactly.
side. Yeah.
So he's just going to be one of those guys. He'll be doing punditry not too far from now, and it's going to be like so many hundred Premier League appearances. It's he's worthy of spot. Yeah, he's not got maybe the trophy cabinet of some of the other pundits, but he's going to be a very good, very, very solid Premier League career, which is all right, to be honest.
Yeah, it's not a bad life, shite. That is it?
No,
a solid shite, Premier League
he's probably
career.
one of the
He's got 63 league goals in fucking hell. Do you know how old he is?
If you what, I've got to go with 34.
Oh, fair enough. He's 33. I didn't realise he was that old. 33.
Oh, he's been around for a fairly long while, you know. Yeah. So
he absolutely has. I think if somebody told me he was 28, I'd have been like, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, you bought it. You'd have bought that straight away as well. Aye. Yeah.
231 league games for West Ham since 2015. 63 league goals. You know, he's probably not going to join the 100 club before he leaves the Premier League. But he won't be far off. And like you say, it's going to flash up that he scored 80 Premier League goals or something like that, and that's pretty phenomenal. And the guy could finish a double European champion. You know, there's every chance West Ham are in with 100%. A shout of the Europa League this year. So you can't complain. He gives it all. He's still quick enough to cause mayhem, and he's got a decent finish on him as well. He's almost like a not quite as good Jamie Vardy, I guess, in a sense.
Probably roughly where he is. I think that's fair. I think that's a fair assessment. Yeah, he's just, you put him in the same bracket as saying on and Bueno right now or something like that. A very, very good Premier League striker.
I'm trying to think, thinking backwards, like maybe like a Bobby Zamora.
I think he's better than Bobby Zamora, but
I reckon. Fulham fans might get annoyed with me with that.
But no, you're not far off the mark. There. Yeah, he's in that bracket.
Crouch. He's a different type of player, but yeah, Crouch.
So it's like you forget that to score 100 Premier League goals is actually quite an achievement. The players that achieve it are all like, oh my god, they're like some of the all time greats.
Yeah.
Antonio's in that sort of
Mark Viduka.
Mark Viduka, that caliber of striker. I think that's
got there eventually. I was struggling, but Mark Viduka, because the people that come into my head are like David Nugent and Peter Odemwingie, and he's much better.
He's much better than they ever were. Yeah.
Folk like Gale and whatnot, he's way better than them. So yeah, Mark Viduka, I think he'll take that, to be fair. I think he'd be quite chuffed. Brighton, Sheila, I think I put in the notes this is probably just something that's gonna happen to De Zerbi's Brighton team, you know, probably once every 6 weeks, that they'll just get it was Everton 5-1 last season, and there was others like that earlier, not quite as dramatic, but I think they've just got it in them that if they don't put away their chances, they'll concede chances, and that always makes them fallible to a sort of surprise 3-0, 4-0, 3-1 kind of game like this against a team like West Ham that are willing to do the dirty work.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, De Zerbi's a fashionable manager at the moment. He plays fashionable football. And all of a sudden, every now and again, you're going to come up across opposition that are, as you say, not afraid to do the dirty work, and this is just how it's going to go. You're just going to get out-fought by the opposition. So yeah, again, it's nothing really to worry about if you're Brighton. Yeah, sure, you want to achieve just as much as last season, but they do have a European campaign to look forward to, which, you know, again, being a Premier League side, they could quite easily go into the latter
stages. And the style of football they play as well, you suspect is going to do well in the Europa League.
Yeah, 100%. So, yeah, I think it's just one of
those. Imagine a Brighton West Ham final in the Europa League. That would be so bizarre.
It would. But no, I think if you're watching the game back, yeah, I don't think you're going to lose much sleep as if you're De Zerbi. You're not going to be too hard on the players. It's like, right, well, but you would just let it go either. But
I just don't know what they can do differently. They win that game 8 out of 10 times.
They couldn't have done anything different. Areola, he had a good game too.
It wasn't as if
they, you know, they never even got close, because they did. That wouldn't be fair. Obviously they scored, but I mean, out with that, it's not as if they didn't get close. It was just the West Ham were better on the day. That's all it is.
Absolutely. The other games, Chelsea 3, Luton 0, Burnley 1, Villa 3, and we touched on Sheffield United 1, City 2, with the three newly promoted teams. They've now played 7 games across the opening 3 game weeks, Sheila, and not a single one of them have picked up a win yet. Is it too early? I guess we're at that funny time of the season. It can be too early to draw conclusions, but I'm starting to think that, you know, we could be looking potentially at sort of 3 of the poorer promoted teams that we've had for a long time, and all 3 look in serious danger of you know, putting up a sort of 20-point Norwich season.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. Like, of the crop of promoted teams we've had in recent years, these guys are quite a far away. Like, I don't think
as a three, you, I think
as a trio, yeah, they're pretty low on quality, particularly Sheffield United and Luton. I think Luton will be probably the breaking of this year, to be honest.
For anybody that doesn't get that reference, they went into the Championship in Scotland and didn't win a single game, scored 4 points. the thing is, I really think Luton could genuinely challenge Derby's record this season, because they were fucking awful against Chelsea. And I think there's two types of awful. There's sort of the Norwich awful, where they play lots of really nice football and get thumped 4-0, and you think, you probably can't get away with that, lads. Like, you're not quite good enough. And then there's the sort of like plucky awful, where you think, like Fulham under Scott Parker or something, where like they dig in and they try really hard and they work really hard and it doesn't quite come off. And you think, don't worry, it'll come good. And they get relegated. Luton just look shit. Look actually, like, objectively shit.
Out of their depth. And I think that you could apply that to all of the promoted teams. Like,
Burnley look a bit more like that Norwich shit I described.
Yeah,
where
exactly.
They look like they're maybe company said, if we play like that all season, we'll be fine. And I was like, get ripped apart by Villa, who aren't Man City. I think you're in a danger of doing an Norwich.
We kind of predicted that when they played Man City in the cup last year and tried to play how they would play against one of the other champions, how they would play against fucking Sunderland. Yeah. Like, no, you're playing City here, lads. You need to show a bit more restraint.
A bit of respect, and just accept your
that
position.
You're limited. You can't just we'll just turn up and we'll just do what Man City do to other teams. Like, that's not going to happen.
And again, Norwich have tried twice under Farke and failed miserably both times.
And that's why I had a bit of a rant about the sort of the disrespect shown to Sean Dyche when he came up with Burnley and established them as a Premier League side.
I think Sheffield United, and I don't like Paul Heckenbottom, and I hope he gets sacked still, but I actually think of the three, I would say Sheffield United are the only ones that have shown signs that they're dogged enough that they might do something. They were dogged against City, they were unlucky against Forest, and they were pretty dogged in that game. And you think, oh, this team looks like it's got a bit of guile, which you kind of need at that end of the Premier League, whereas Burnley look naive and Luton just look miles off it.
Yeah, I think that's, I can't really add much to that. I think you've summed it up pretty well.
And all three are hoping that Everton are the one team that's shitter than the three of them, who are bottom at the moment.
Yeah, they got beat by Wolves. Yeah, that's true. But I mean, look, I watched obviously the highlights from the Everton game. There are signs of life there. They are creating chances.
Just Neil Mopai's on the end of them.
Dan
Schumer that missed the one-on-one. Yeah.
Yeah, and there was like, what was it, fucking Dobbin or something? Sounds like Harry, from Harry Potter or something. Dobby. There's no chance in hell I'd have a guy called Dobbin in my team.
Instant.
Anyway, instantly, no, you're not going to be up too much, are you? You just, no. Nah. I think there are signs of life at Everton, whereas there's not much to say about the other three promoted teams.
No, and I think people thought Burnley were going to be really exciting and sort of be a bit Brentford-y, but Brentford have guile. Brentford are very,
Brentford
very
are good so, at, they're, at they're being solid. Solid. They're solid, first and foremost. And yeah, they do have players that are capable of a little bit of something else, but they're solid first and fancy second. So yeah, when you play Brentford,
attacking team.
Yeah, when you play Brentford, and not only that, when you play Brentford, you know you've been in the game because they make it like a physical game. Whereas I don't think Burnley have the capability of doing that, which is ironic, considering it's Burnley we're talking about.
And both Burnley and Sheffield United are arguably worse teams. Yeah, we don't follow the Championship particularly closely, but they've both lost their best players from last year's campaign and haven't replaced them. And so you've ended up with two teams that have come up from the Championship and they've got worse. Which, when does that ever happen?
Have they really spent much? I know that
Burnley have signed somebody. But... Yeah, Burnley have signed somebody for a decent bit of cash. I can't comment on Sheffield United. I forgot Ollie McBurnie was there. If you struggle to dislike him enough,
if you've got Ollie McBurnie in your sight, and I think he got off the bench against City.
Oh right,
I think he got off the bench against City.
He did. Yeah.
And I'm like, oh Jesus Christ! If you're bringing on McBurnie.
Oh, cheesy peeps, man.
He nearly got in the way for the equaliser. Like he was in an offside position, so he could have
did his best to fuck it. Yeah, exactly.
But
I just think, from the early evidence, and granted it's only two games for Burnley and Luton, but the early evidence, these look like three bad teams. And the four at the bottom now without a win, Everton, Sheffield, Burnley and Luton, look like they'll be the four that are going to stay there. Like you see signs of life at Everton. And I think where the difference will be is, so who have Everton played so far? Fulham, Villa, Wolves. I think the difference is that when Everton play Luton, Sheffield and Burnley, even this bad Everton team, you fancy probably to be favourite and to get the job done against those three sides. Mm. Luton, man. I watched the Chelsea game on Friday And granted, Chelsea made hard work of it at 1-0, and they did have a chance before Chelsea sort of went, holy shit, let's kill this off. It was like a 15-year-old fighting their 5-year-old brother, and they land one punch, and they've gone, whoa, fucking hell, I put this to bed. But it was, I just don't know, I can't believe they got promoted. I don't think I've ever seen a worse team. I feel bad, because Luton, it's kind of cool that they're in league, and they're plucky and all that kind of thing, but I genuinely am not sure, and I can't really recall the 8-point Derby team or 9 points, whatever it was, but I'm not sure I've seen a worse team. They are properly just miles off it. And in the two games we've seen so far, it looks like a Carabao Cup tie, sort of a third round Carabao Cup tie where you think, oh, that Luton team are all right. Like, it'll be interesting to see how they get on, and then they get papped and you think, ah, fair enough. That's probably why they're elite. But they're in the Premier League. The only thing is, you hope is that they stick by Rob Edwards, a bit like Burnley did with Dyche, because he obviously came up, went straight back down, came straight back up, and then established them. You maybe hope that they can do that with Rob Edwards and sort of give them a fighting chance of redoing it. But they brought that boy on off the bench, the one that's played in the National League,
every division,
championship.
With the same team. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, fucker, you can. you can tell why he started his career as a non-league player, because that looks like exactly where he should be. Like, fucking hell. He's the one that gave away the goal in the first game as well, but he just looks like a total donkey. But they all do. It's like,
that's why we're number one in Guyana. You won't be.
It's just like, hopefully
you're not getting like fuck off the Guardian podcast calling players total donkeys.
Donkeys, yeah, exactly. That's a shame. two games to go. Brentford won, Palace won. It's there. I believe their fifth top flight draw since Brentford came up, which is quite interesting. Probably not a huge amount to say on that. And then Bournemouth 0, Tottenham 2, just to finish off with a wee line on the Ange Revolution, Sheila, which continues to go well.
Yeah, it does. Again, already touched on him a couple of times because, like, he seems to have transformed him. You could see what he's trying to do, whatever message he's putting across. It seems as though the players are buying into it, which obviously helps. But I think it's just what he's done really well is he's bought wisely, which doesn't really come as a surprise when you're talking about Evelyn. If you know him from up his time in Scotland, that doesn't come as a surprise when it comes to Postecoglou. But again, it's just making best use of what's there already. And it's not like Spurs had a bad team as such, just playing murder football. And because he likes to play ultra-attacking football, just seems like he's galvanised the fans and the whole side. I think it's just, like, to lose Harry Kane, it's like, I think it's one of the, in his pre-match press conference on Match of the Day, it was like, oh, you've lost 40 goals a season. Like, none of your boys are going to score 40 goals a season. And you watch him, again, you watch his time up in Scotland, the goals were coming from all over the place. It's not anything he's
five different goal scorers plus an own goal so far this season. So he's already showing that, kind of popping up from everywhere.
And that, yeah, again, and again, like, I think, you know, if you were to ask a manager, would you rather all your goals come from one source, or would you rather they were spread throughout the team? They'd probably say spread throughout the team, because it's harder to defend against 10 boys that are capable of scoring as opposed to one.
Yeah, so, and that's Richarlison and Son having not scored yet, who you would have put money on being the first two on that list at the start of the season. So I think you're absolutely right. Madison's just, again, saying earlier about United just being in for weird players and not in for other players, like, why on earth have they not signed James Maddison? He's such a good player, and he's 40 million's looking like bargain of the century already. He was absolutely superb again against Bournemouth, and then he's brought Saar and Bissouma from out from the dark. He's got Destiny at fullback, who nobody had heard of until 3 weeks ago. It's crazy, actually, to think that Richarlison's playing so badly, because it's being masked so well by the fact he's got everybody else playing brilliantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, there were times last season where his, like, Son didn't score or assist. You'd be like, oh, he's fucking shite. And he looked shite. But even now, in a Postecoglou team, right, he may not get hit with a goal contribution, but he still has a good performance.
Yeah.
And Postecoglou's. I'm going to stop calling him that. I'm just going to call him Ange.
Ange. That's what everybody else calls him.
That's what Big Ange's Celtic looked like. Yeah, you would get players that might not contribute on the score sheet, but would definitely help the team. So, and again, they will play great football. They'll be very entertaining to watch. So, they've already beat cuffed Man United. Who knows who else could be next?
Yeah, and I am surprised he hasn't been back to Celtic for anyone. I think most people thought he might have gone for Hatate, and he mentioned Hatate in his pre-match actually last week, and when he was talking about Mitoma, and he hasn't been in for Kyogo. And I know a lot of people don't think Kyogo is necessarily Premier League quality, but the guy's a finisher. And he's clearly a goal scorer in the Ange system, and it's not really working for Richarlison. So I thought he might have gone in. He might have gone in for him. But it just seems to be going down a different route.
Yeah, I still think Hatate might eventually end up there. I mean, he's definitely the one that that sticks out for me in that Celtic team. As Keogh does stick out, I just don't think the attributes that make him successful up here will necessarily apply down there.
Just fair.
So,
their next games, they've got Burnley before the international break, which, as we've just said, should be a guaranteed 3 points, and then they come back to Sheffield United. So it could be a decent start. Then they play Arsenal and Liverpool. So that they'll be the next tests. I'll be at the Liverpool game, going to see that Spurs-Liverpool game at the end of September, so that'll be exciting. But yeah, long may Ange continue being ever so slightly not as good as Chelsea. That would be the perfect place for me to see Spurs for the rest of the season. North of the border, Aberdeen 2, St Mirren 2. We got away with one, somewhat, to say the least. St Mirren with 2 disallowed goals. Aberdeen getting a penalty awarded by VAR. Then there was accusations of a double touch by Bojan Miovski, although none of the imagery of that is remotely conclusive. I was lucky enough to be on Red Tinted Glasses today, having a sort of deep dive into that. So if you did want a deep dive into the Aberdeen St Mirren game, then check out Red Tinted Glasses as well, and you get to listen to me for a bit more time. But in summary, poor performance, got away with one. And as I said, after Livingston, Paisley's not a place we got any points last season. So to have got a point there this season is an improvement already. And with the Edinburgh side struggling so much, that we'll take getting points we didn't score last year. We just need to make sure that we perform at home. Hibs annoyingly sacked Lee Johnson just before they play Aberdeen. It's fucking typical. We always play new manager bounces. And I was really enjoying how much of a geyser Lee Johnson was after his F1 driving his car comments last week. But yeah, he finally got his marching orders after a 3-2 defeat to Livingston. Dunfermline, Sheila, beaten in the derby by Raith.
A disappointing result, obviously, given it's a derby. But I haven't seen any of the game. I haven't seen any of the highlights. Couldn't bring myself to watch them. I was working. I just think it's going to be a long season for Dunfermline. I don't think we'll get relegated. I just think there's going to be a lot of... It's only 1-0, but I think it's going to be a lot of tight games at this moment in time. And I just think McVeigh's he's not overreaching as such. I think he's just trying to establish himself as in the championship, and maybe next year we can, you know, be a bit more ambitious. But just the sort of the signings in forward areas haven't materialised as of yet. And obviously the season has started now, so it's very rare that you're going to pick up any decent free agents after that time. So yeah, it's going to be a boring season. But after the Peter Grant Yogi Hughes bin fire that was 2 seasons ago, I'll take it.
Yeah, and to be fair, you said right from the end of last season that this might be a case of consolidation before then being able to look at being more adventurous in future seasons. And we also said at the start we would discuss the Luis Rubiales news. I think everybody has seen it now. He grabbed the Spanish woman player and kissed her on the lips.
Jenny Hermoso.
That's it. Thanks, Sheila. He was rightly condemned for it immediately. Then he said it was consensual. What you're moaning about? Then she said, "No, it wasn't consensual." And the Spanish FA said, "You're lying. We can all see from the video it was consensual, and we're going to sue you over your comments." Then both the men's and women's Spanish national teams have gone on strike and said they won't play again until he's removed. FIFA have suspended him from his position, but UEFA are yet to comment, despite the fact he's a vice president of UEFA. And then the news yesterday was that his mum has gone on hunger strike in a church in Spain due to the witch hunt over his son, which, on such a serious topic, it's so hard not to laugh at a 46-year-old man's mum going on hunger strike in a church in Spain because her son kissed a woman on live TV that didn't want it. So it's honestly so hard not to laugh at how ridiculous it is, but it's such a serious, it's a genuinely serious situation for a number of reasons. The kiss in isolation, but the reaction, the fact that Spanish FA's reaction was to say, "We're going to sue you because we can see it's consensual," must be so incredibly triggering to any woman that's been the subject of sexual abuse or a sexual assault, and then is constantly told, no, that didn't actually happen, or that's not what happened, and just being gaslighted about it. And we all fucking seen it. That's the mad
thing.
Yeah,
we all seen it. I was watching the final, and my girlfriend, who's got no interest in football, female or otherwise, came in and was just watching like the medal ceremony, and you're like, that's baldy guys, you know.
fairly
going for it. Yes, exactly. And again, it's just the Spain's women's team, it's quite a sad story, to be honest. Like, obviously they've just won the World Cup, but before that it was like, I think, two World Cups they had qualified for since, that, you know, that, like, it's like women's World Cups were a thing. And, you know, when we put that in the context next to the men's, it would be absolutely unthinkable to go for that to happen.
And they're by far the most dominant domestic team in Barcelona, with a number of the players that then didn't end up in the squad.
Exactly. And just going further back, like, the same coach that was in place for that period of time, like, they had the same, before the current coach, they had a guy, I can't remember his name, was there for like 27 years or something like that.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if it's unthinkable, but can you imagine how long, like for a Spain to go 27 years and only qualify for two World Cups, if it was the men's team, there's no way in hell you'd be able to convince anybody that the same coach was in charge for that whole period of time. And apparently he was quite an abusive guy himself. But the fact that the Spanish FA allowed them to get away with such conduct for such a length of time just goes to show how much they regard their own national football team. And then, like, obviously the current crop have gone on to win the World Cup. This other coach, that he's a bit of a strange character also.
There was an open letter written by 15 of the current Spain international players against his coercive and controlling behaviour, and the headline of it was, he made them keep their bedroom doors open at night so that he knew that they were in, which is astounding to any adult, that you would ever treat an adult like that. But for a male coach in a position of power to treat female football players like that is obviously a whole additional level of problems.
Exactly. And again, like, the double standard presented is unbelievable. Can you imagine? I was speaking to one of the girls at work about this. She's, again, not really interested in football, but was following the story because it's a story. But it was like, at the time, I couldn't think of any player that played for Spain. But I was like, can you imagine asking Sergio Ramos to keep your bedroom door open tonight? So I know you're in, you would be out in your arse within days.
Exactly.
And it would be exactly. And again, obviously, Rubias conduct at the medal ceremony, he's not going to do that to if it was the Spain World Cup winning team. He's not going to grab Fabregas and then kiss him on the lips without, you know,
Fabregas didn't want to. Isn't going to be forced into doing something like that. You know, that was the argument that, like, oh, they're Latin, it's normal. You're like, that's just a nonsense thing to say. You would never say that in a different context. And then, you know, showing the video of the jockey who won the race at the weekend, and the owner of the horse gave him a big kiss on the lips. And you're like, it's different for a number of reasons. The primary difference is the power dynamic. Is if he, as a bloke, did not want that to happen when she went in for the kiss, it wouldn't have happened. You know, he has the power in that situation to be able to say no. Whereas she absolutely doesn't, and you can see that from the incident.
Not even that, like. It's not to compare to what on camera look fairly similar incidents and be like, oh, well, these two things are the same, but they're treated differently. They're not the same because it's not necessarily how it's definitely not how Rubiales felt about it. It's how Jenny Hermoso feels about it.
Exactly.
She thinks that she does not give consent, so it's not for him to be like, oh, but she did. Like, no, that this is a thing. It's not how the perpetrator in this feels about it. It's how the victim, in this case, Jenny Hermoso, feels about it. So that's it. And again, the same girl as I was speaking to at work, she was like, it's difficult for men to understand because it never happens to them. Nearly enough the same game scale that it happens to women. So when it first happens, there's maybe an initial shock. So like, again, another argument that's been brought up against Barmoso is that, oh, she didn't slap him in the face or anything like that as soon as it happened. It's like, she's just won the World Cup. The roller coaster of emotions, and then the shock as well. Like, you need time to process
shock,
that.
Shock that her boss, effectively, her boss, yeah, boss exactly. has just and then, grabbed her face and kissed her on the lips. Exactly, of course, she doesn't have time to, how, to think rationally how, about that.
Exactly. How mental would it be, right, Jamie? And this goes for me as well. If we did a good job at our work and our bosses just came up to us and gave us a kiss on the lips,
yeah, it'd be obscene.
It'd be absurd. You'd be like, what yeah. the fuck are you doing?
Exactly. If one of my bosses went up to one of my female colleagues and you know, she'd just say, passed some exams or, you know, done very well, and he grabbed both her cheeks and kissed her flush on the lips, they, like, the entire office would be like, what be like, the what fuck have you just done? Like, what exactly. the actual fuck? Like,
exactly.
That is insane. And I don't for a second expect that the female colleague would slap him in the face or would run away or would
no,
do anything
she'd be
like
stunned.
That.
Stunned. She'd be stunned.
Yeah. The whole thing's just bonkers. It's absolutely, and it's just like I said at the top, how does this shit keep happening? And like, how?
Because there's no
society where this people think this can be remotely acceptable.
Well, I can look. I think again. I think what the mistake that Rubiales has made, other than obviously the obvious mistake that he's made, is if he did maybe came out and said, "Look, I'm really, really sorry. I just got carried away, but I'm going to go do sensitivity training and blah, 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 and try and my best to rectify this mistake." But he's not. He's doubled down on, like, no, it's just as much. It's her fault. It's her fault this all happened. And it's just like,
she consented to it as if we've had the conversation.
It's exactly like it. That's quite clearly never happened. Do you know what I mean? So, and then the whole Spanish FA have backed him in that sense. And, like, Infantino's FIFA president comments before the game, well, go show men why you should be paid the same and all that sort of shit. It just creates a really difficult
toxic,
environment,
horrible,
for,
toxic atmosphere for women.
Female for women to thrive in.
Yeah.
Which is not good. So until it changes at the top down, and these sort of things will continue to happen. But again, there's no. Again, I think for once, maybe the at least the Spanish players have kind of come out in a public, male players, I should say, have come out in a public show of support for Hermoso, which obviously in the men's game, when it came to like Mendy and stuff like that, it was quite abhorrent to see the sort of the backing that he got from his professionals. So I think the more and more that we see male footballers take a stand and be like, no, we're not going to have this. We're not going to have any sort of conduct like that, either towards fellow athletes or fellow humans, then it will continue to happen until, but again, it's just for Spain, the Spain case in particular, it's quite a long history of disrespect and harassment that have gone on there. So that needs to be cut out by the root, I would suggest.
Yeah, absolutely. The Union of European Clubs now, which represents the top 121 teams in Europe, has urged them to stand down immediately. There was protests in the streets in Spain today calling for him to resign, and he continues to maintain the position that it's a witch hunt and he hasn't done anything wrong. It's just, I think it's just systemic now of a much wider problem that football has, and that's its relationship with sexual violence and its relationship towards women generally. And by God, I hope we do this podcast long enough that one day we can sort of get through a season without some kind of a horrible story that we have to discuss. And it's wishful thinking. And you know, it's one thing for me and you to get wound up. And I think, as your colleague has alluded to, we don't even begin to understand the half of it. We can't for a moment empathize or genuinely sympathize with how that would make any woman feel generally, you know, your girlfriends obviously just seen that and immediately thought, probably much quicker than you or I have, what the fuck is he doing? I know that's not acceptable. And so I think that, you know, there's so many female football fans and people involved in the game that it must just be tiresome and upsetting to see it so regularly and to read it. And this was just such a public display as well. It's genuinely grotesque. But we'll touch on it again next week, no doubt, depending on what happens over the last 7 days. And to end on the fact that his mum's on hunger strike is just genuinely a bit bonkers. But yeah, it's been a fantastic episode, Sheila. Thank you very much, as always, for your time for jumping on. That's two in a row now that we've batted out successfully. Hopefully we continue to maintain our position as the number one football podcast in all of Guyana. I look forward to seeing where else we might be climbing the charts next week. Who knows? Maybe it'll spread from Guyana. And then, you know, then it'll be like French Guyana, Brazil. Imagine we became the number one football podcast in Brazil. And then they'd be making it.
Oh, no, I'm really sorry for what I said about Richarlison's tattoos. No, I think they're wonderful tattoos.
Fantastic. Well, that's brilliant, Sheila. Thanks for your time, and I'll speak to you again next week.